Welcome to True Crime Garage. Wherever you are, whatever you are doing, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Nick, and with me as always, well, he's simply one of the best in the biz, so I refer to him as the Barry Lurd of podcasting. He is the captain.
They call me Lurd the Turd. It's good to be seen, and it's good to see you. Thanks for listening. Thanks for telling a friend.
Today we are drinking War Elephant by the fine people over at Rushing Duck Brewing Company. Garage grade 3 3/4 bottle caps out of 5. War Elephant is a double IPA. It's hoppy, malty, and I would say light citrus notes. And as one might expect from the powerful name, it is a powerful beer, big flavor, and a high ABV.
This powerful brew is brought to you by this powerful crew.
First up, we have Alex, and we are going to say that Alex is in parts unknown, which is very fitting because Alex is a truck driver. We have a lot of truck drivers that listen to the show, and Alex says our little garage show makes the miles fly by. So shout out to Alex and all the trucker friends out there. Stay safe on the roads, my friends.
And in real parts unknown, we have
Christy, who says each day she does some garage time because there's nothing like a little homicide story and the captain to get you through her day. Mm-hmm.
Call me, girl. And in the Bronx, we got Michael. Big shout out to you, Michael.
And in that state up north, we have Rachel in Grand Rapids, and we also have Jill from Holt.
And a big we like you jib to Gia in Lakeland, Florida.
And a cheers, mates, to Steven from Suwanee, Georgia. And last but not least, a shout out to David in the CSL Knoxville night shift.
Yeah, and a big shout out to anybody rocking the night shift.
So thank you, everybody, for all the cold beers for this week's show. If you want to help us out with next week's show, go to truecrimegarage.com and click on the donate button.
That's enough of the business. Gather around.
Grab a chair.
Grab a beer.
Let's talk some true crime. We've done 3 episodes on this case, and today makes 4, and sometimes, Captain, that just works out for me. It works out well for me, well for my ostrich brain that I'm walking around with, right?
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes, in most of the case, this is the case, this is the scenario, that we cover a new case each week. So we have but 5, maybe 7 days to research it all, work through it, record it. It's like a damn tornado.
Mm-hmm.
Well, these 4-part cases are a little different. We get just about 2 weeks to kind of tear through them and maybe see what's going on a little clearer. So when we are provided with that luxury, I like to kind of take a look at it and form an opinion after I've digested as much information as I can. So sometimes for me, it's like comparing following a trail of breadcrumbs rather than reading a choose-your-own-adventure book.
Okay.
So here, and I like to do this when I think it applies, and what I'm looking for is this. I'm looking for something that seems to be the truth in regarding my opinion of what I think could have happened to Jeanette DePalma. So going back to our victim here, and as we discussed our victim, what kind of person is she? Was she a wild child, or was she a good girl? We heard everything all over the shop there, right? The witnesses, as we said, all over the shop when it came to her character and her personality.
Yes, a lot of speculation.
Then when we get to where she was last seen, walking, and then some dispute about whether she went to a house or not.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to get into some things that I found a little strange, and when it boils down to maybe what Jeanette was up to on that day, on that day that she went missing. So what can we learn by her behavior from what witnesses has told us, from what people have told us she was planning to do that day? The first thing we hear is that she was going to go to a friend's house, But the way that it really boils down, Captain, is that it sounds to me like she was trying to get out of going to the friend's house. She woke up that day. She called her friend. She was supposed to be there in the afternoon, and she said, you know what? She told her friend, I can't go to your home. My mother will not let me. I have some cleaning and some chores that I'm supposed to do, so therefore I will not make it. Later, her friend says, well, no, we've set up these plans with these boys, and I only set up these plans because you told me you were going to be here, so you have to figure this out. You have to be here. She says, okay, I'll hitchhike a ride. I'll hitch a ride and make it to your house. I'm doing a little assuming here, Captain, but I'm assuming she was trying to ditch her friend, because then she tells her mother that she is going to said friend's house.
Right.
Mother grants her permission all of a sudden. And the mother, she even offers her to give her a ride to that friend's house.
Yeah.
And the Jeanette says, no, no, it's a nice day out. I'm going to walk and I'm going to go to the train station. Then we see Jeanette asking her sister if she would like to walk with her, stating to her sister that she was going off to see a boy. And her sister recalls even the name Tommy, but knows nothing else of this boy or this person named Tommy. The sister says no and has plans of her own and won't be walking with Jeanette that day. From there, Jeanette phones another friend looking for, and this part is not clear, but either looking for a ride from her friend or for her friend to accompany her on foot. Regardless, she didn't seem to be looking to go alone to me, okay, wherever she was heading that day. And the thing that I strongly question here is Jeanette's intent. Was she really planning to go to her friend's house? She failed at the attempt to cancel those plans, tells her sister that she's going somewhere else, and then turns down a very convenient ride from her mother. If you're in a hurry to get to your friend's house that day, you take the ride from your mother.
Right.
If you might be going somewhere other than where you told your mother,
you don't take the ride.
You were going, you turn down the ride. I think we might be looking at a strong possibility that she either had other plans that day that we are unaware of, or she wanted to go visit somebody else other than that friend, maybe even a boy.
Right.
If she did have plans to go out, I really wish someone could come forward or someone could piece together where and with whom those plans were to be.
Yeah, but you can speculate a little bit, I mean, based off what the sister said.
Mm-hmm.
She's going to go see this boy.
I would really like to know why that person never came forward to tell us that they had plans with Jeanette that day, but yet she never arrived.
Mm-hmm.
Because then you got to put a big circle around that person. So I strongly think that one of two scenarios played out something like this. She went somewhere and met someone, and they spent some time together that day, and she went off walking to God knows whose house. But while walking, she accepted a ride. Now, here's my thought on this, Captain. Whether she went searching for a ride or whether she accepted a ride. In my opinion, this would be from someone she knew or from someone that she may have wanted to know.
Mm-hmm.
And I throw that in there for a couple of reasons, okay? One thing that we heard about Jeanette when we talked about her personality and her victimology, let's say, was there was a big question about hitchhiking. There was half the people said she would never hitchhike. We hear her tell her friend she was going to hitch a ride that day. Then we have the other people saying, yeah, it was pretty common. You know, we did it, she did it, everybody did it. What I did hear time and time again, the one thing that didn't seem to be as much confusion as whether she would hitch a ride or not, most of the people that were saying that if she were to hitchhike, Jeanette was not stupid, that she was not going to take a ride from someone she didn't know. Okay, but I threw in the possibility of someone she maybe wanted to know.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is, could an older boy have slowed down and offered the girl a ride? And what I mean by this, I don't mean like a 30-year-old man comes along in his, you know, in his dad wagon, and he's like, hey, you want to ride? You know, Jeanette's 16 years old.
Mm-hmm.
She might have accepted a ride from, we know you had to be 17 and a half in those days to have your license. What if she got in the car with somebody that was 18 or 19, 20, 21 even? Someone that looked to be in her age group. Someone that looked the role of somebody that might run in one of her circles or her friend's circles. There's a very suspicious story here to me. And before I get into it, I do want to do a quick mention of something that I was thinking about on the way over here, Captain, and I wanted to get your opinion on this. And this will play a role in the later part of my opinion of what might have happened to Jeanette DePalma. One thing we didn't talk about yesterday, it didn't hit me until this morning, but when we talked about Red, the houseless man that lived in the woods, mm-hmm. One thing that we didn't discuss was, remember when they found Jeanette's body on September 19th, 1972, they were looking through the woods. They were combing that area. They arrive at the cliff known as Devil's Teeth, and they find her body up there. The strange thing to me is, like, I kind of almost picture this as like I'm watching like Law and Order or Criminal Minds or something like that, you know, where they find a body. They're like, oh, we got this body. And then you hear them start talking. It could be a female. She's been here a while. And if this were a TV show, then off in the distance somewhere, you would hear another officer going, Captain?
Yes.
Somebody's living over here. We got somebody living in the area.
Right.
I'm wondering why, you know, there was so much suspicion about this Red man, about the houseless guy. Why so much suspicion about a guy that they didn't seem to come across his dwelling when they were out looking for her body?
Right.
Like, wouldn't that be like the biggest of red flags to you if you happen to find a body in that area?
Maybe that's why he wasn't looked into that much.
Maybe that's why. Yeah. Maybe that's why they spoke with him briefly and then cleared him and let him go. But anyway, there's a weird story within this big story that I find very strange. And that's the story of the 21-year-old dude that we talked about yesterday that goes by the name of Terry Rickle. Terry Rickle was the guy that alerted police in October about the man Red that's living in the woods near where the body was found.
Right.
What I find suspicious about his story is it possible that he's giving the police some kind of false lead? Is he going to the police department? This would be about the same time that the stories from the newspaper regarding the murder and death of Jeanette DePalma start disappearing from the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And we do know that on some occasions, somebody that either has information or somebody that's guilty of a horrible act will sometimes interject themselves into the investigation. Why? Because they want to know what's going on with the investigation. What better way than to go down to the police department and give them some potentially false lead? You could send them off your trail and figure out what they're doing possibly at the same time. I find his story a little suspicious, and there's a portion of his story that we left out yesterday, and it's this. He seemed to, one, know that Red lived in that area. Two, he seemed to be able to point out to the police that he believed that Red had left that area sometime shortly after Jeanette's body would have been placed there.
Mm-hmm.
His reasoning for knowing about Red and for knowing about, you know, knowledge about the area and maybe even Red's timeline is this. He states that some of his friends would on occasion spy on this Red character. And the reason why they would spy on him is because sometimes, remember, he was getting paid in cash. And a lot of times he would come back to his little campsite, let's call it, and he would bury the cash or he would hide his money in different places. And supposedly these, you know, I don't have the ages or the names of these guys that he tells this story about to the police.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming they're roughly his age. So let's say men, that they would be over the age of 18. That these guys are watching this Red guy hide his money, and then when he's off, when he goes off to work, or when he's not in the area, sometimes he would go grocery shopping, they would come up and steal his money.
Possibly a reason why he left the area.
Yeah, very good point. If somebody keeps showing up while you're gone or in the middle of the night and stealing your money, you might leave the area just for that purpose. The thing I'm getting at is I don't know how much suspicion or how much shade to throw on this Terry Rickle. Maybe there's none that needs to be thrown on him at all. I'm just getting at that I find his story a little suspicious, and I'm also wondering if the police, upon hearing his story and hearing the detectives hearing his story, now we know they followed the red angle, mm-hmm. and they started looking into that, and they started looking for this man known only by the name of Red. I'm wondering if how much they checked into this Terry Rickle guy or his friends. And furthermore, if Terry Rickle knows so much about the area, about that specific area where her body was found, and his friends are on occasions watching the area, how come they didn't see anything suspicious? How come they didn't have anything more suspicious to report about this? I find the whole story either made up. Maybe it's just made up. Maybe he had some reason to not like this red guy, or maybe he was just scared of this guy that lived in the woods, and he kind of goes, oh, I read in the paper they found her body there. I think that's where that guy lives. Maybe it was just something. Maybe it's something as loose as that. Or
a lot of people can't understand other people's lifestyles, so they treat them like they're less than human,
mm-hmm.
when it's just a different choice of lifestyle.
Yeah. Or maybe it's something more sinister to inject yourself into the investigation, try to figure out what direction the investigation is taking, and maybe even provide them with some kind of false lead.
Well, and there's some speculation that she got in a car with somebody that maybe she knew, right? Or was an acquaintance of. And so is there any evidence that she knew this Terry Rickle?
Well, there was speculation that she would only get into a car of somebody she knew. And I actually believe that she got into a car, whether she was offered a ride or was asking for a ride, and I do believe it was probably somebody she knew. Now, there is no proof. There's no evidence to suggest that she knew Terry Rickle or did not know him. We don't know this.
Just find his story pretty fishy.
Well, I just really, yeah, I find his story questionable. To the point where I just wanted to offer that up for food for thought, as food for thought. I don't necessarily, was he involved or was his friends involved? It's possible, but it's probably not super likely when you look at the whole spectrum of things.
Right.
Now, the reason why I think that she knew she would only get in the car with somebody she knew or got into the car of somebody she knew is this, because of where her body was found. She's found on top of this cliff, and we have investigators, we have detectives and police officers that found her that day that were part of the search that said that they had slipped several times when they tried to make it up to that cliff, that they had fallen, that some of them couldn't even make it to the top of that cliff.
Right.
And then when they removed her body from there, the fire truck had to come in and park itself at the base of the cliff and shoot the ladder up. To use the ladder and form this weird, almost kind of conveyor belt of getting her out of there.
Mm-hmm.
They had to put in lots of man hours and time to getting her out of there.
What you're getting at is that
it would be hard for somebody to carry her up there.
It's hard for somebody to kill her then carry her up there.
I almost think that she went up there with somebody.
Yeah.
Either somebody she knew or somebody she trusted.
Things got out of hand.
She followed somebody up there, and for whatever reason, I think that that person probably strangled her and left her there. And I think the reason, a big portion of the reason why this has not been solved is there's actually, I believe, many reasons why this has not been solved. And the first one of those is I would state that they didn't investigate her disappearance. Remember, it was reported as a
runaway.
And we don't know if it was the parents that reported it that way or the police.
Right, because the parents changed their story on that as well.
And the police say that it was the parents that called it in as a runaway. However, we see another case, yes, it's in another county, but it's the same time period, of a family calling in their daughter missing, and the police are the ones that said, no, she's a runaway.
Right.
So this could have happened in Jeanette's case. And the problem with that is, and we got into this, it's a lot... Captain, you and I agreed. There's some similarities to this and to the serial case that was covered in their first season, where you're asking
Adnan Syed's case. Yeah,
thank you. You're asking teenagers to tell you their whereabouts and what they were doing and who they were with 6 weeks ago. They weren't really investigating Jeanette DePalma's case until after her body turned up 6 weeks and one day after she was missing.
Yeah.
If they would have treated it like a disappearance or an endangered disappeared case rather than a runaway, they would have been speaking to her friends the day after or 2 days after, and they might be able to tell you where they were, what they were doing, who they were with.
Do you believe this crime is satanic or occult-like in any nature?
No, I actually think that it probably just goes with the times, that it's, you know, the early 70s. The thing is, with this whole satanic panic, one thing that people fail to recognize is a lot of this was brought about by Charles Manson and his crew.
Yeah.
Because when you hear this horrible story of these horrible people that went in to a home, and it's technically a home invasion. They go into this home and they terrorize and kill these people out in California, painting blood on the walls. That was the biggest news of it's some of the biggest news of last century.
Yeah.
And to hear that, and that spreads across, it happened in California and it spreads across the Bible Belt and the news there and all the way to the East Coast. And then you have parents and police everywhere where they start to think, if it happened out there, this is the new wave of crime. This is the new wave of criminal. And all these teenagers with their long hair and they're all hippies and they're smoking drugs. This is what we're going to see in the future. And I think a lot of times when you had either teenage victims or teenage perpetrators of crimes, of murders and such, that all of a sudden Satan got involved. All of a sudden witchcraft got involved. And it happened for a lot of... in many cases in the 70s and many cases in the 80s and even up until the 90s. It's just something, I just don't see that being a piece of this case. And I think a large part of that is we don't know what happened to her. And she's found at a location called the Devil's Teeth. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. When we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down.
If you're thinking of starting therapy, I highly recommend that you give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/garage today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/garage. This show is proudly sponsored by BetterHelp. Check out BetterHelp.com/garage today.
The best part of spring cleaning takeaway is the post-clean clarity you get. It's kind of like when you find out that you've been paying a fortune for wireless. When Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. It's time to switch to Mint Mobile. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all of your existing contacts. Ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited time deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. Save a lot of money with Mint Mobile. Get their great mobile wireless service delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. That's premium service at a great price. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/TCG. That's mintmobile.com/TCG. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/TCG. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
All right, we're back. Cheers, mates.
And we're very happy to be with author Jesse Pollock. He was one half of the author duo that wrote the book Death on the Devil's Teeth, The Strange Murder That Shocked Suburban New Jersey.
So, Jesse, since the book has been released for a couple of years, where are you guys at currently on this investigation?
Well, the interesting thing with Mark and I is, you know, with the benefit of there being a magazine, the letters have kind of never stopped coming in. The first letter they received about the case was in 97 or 98, and it's just been a stream of them every year since then. So even with the book coming out in 2015 and a lot of things being answered, with all of the additional questions that the book has opened up, we still have been getting all these letters regarding suspects, the occult connection, possible related cases. And, you know, sometimes they turn out to be nothing, but other times we found some very, very interesting things.
Talk about the letters, Jesse. What were some of the more interesting items that came out that were presented to you through these letters?
One of the most interesting things that we've heard from a reader so far involves the supposed occult objects found around her body. Now, like you guys discussed in episodes 1 and 2, it's not really clear what was found around her, but the general consensus is there were sticks and stones. They may have been arranged. They might not have been. They may have just been a cross and some stones above her head. They may have been a trapezoidal perimeter of logs, which appeared, that description appeared in the newspapers. So, assuming that one, that newspaper description was true, the trapezoidal coffin-shaped perimeter, you know, we just thought, okay, it's supposed to look like a coffin. And then we got an email from a guy about a year after the book came out, and he was saying, oh, I think you guys should know this. The trapezoid is the most satanic symbol in the Church of Satan. And I was like, I researched LaVeyan Satanism and even Hollywood Satanism, you know, Satanism light, whatever you want to call it, all kinds of Satanism while writing Death on the Devil's Teeth with Mark. And I never saw the trapezoid come up. But then I did some digging based on what this guy said. And sure enough, there were interviews that LaVey gave in the 80s and the 90s where he does say that, you know, the most occult object, you know, shape, whatever, is the trapezoid. You know, if you look at the back of the dollar bill, what do you see? A pyramid with the top cut off. That's a trapezoid. And basically, if you go through the literature that LaVey put out, it boils down to the shape of a trapezoid is used to open up a portal between the living and the dead, which, you know, if you believe these sensational articles and headlines about Jeanette's murder being a satanic sacrifice, it does make sense that she would be laid out in a alleged portal between the living and the dead. So that was one that kind of made the hairs on the back of my neck stand up, because the whole time I was writing the book with Mark, it was, oh, it's just supposed to look like a coffin. You know, that's the big thing, the big spooky thing. Oh, it's coffin iconography. But then to get an email from someone and have it pan out that there is literature to back it up, that no, this shape is important in LaVeyan Satanism, and it's supposed to literally open up a portal between the realm of the living and the dead. I mean, it's really chilling to think of.
There's a lot of fishy rumors about Jeanette's case files going missing. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yeah, that was the biggest thing in the whole lore of this case for years. It was the big shocking reveal. You know, anytime Mark would dig into the case back in the early 2000s, before he and I teamed up, he would always hit this brick wall of, oh, no, you know, the Springfield police say the case file was destroyed when Hurricane Floyd rolled through in 1999 and flooded a great percentage of Union County. So, you know, we figured, okay, well, I guess the story kind of ends there with the files. You know, it's not uncommon to hear something stupid like that. Files are kept in a basement somewhere in a area that's prone to flooding. It's unfortunate. There were a lot of accusations and letters that the magazine got that it was a police cover-up. But these things do happen. So, whatever, we soldiered on. And then halfway through writing the book, somewhere around 2013, 2014, we spoke with a retired guy from the Springfield Police Department who later worked in the Detective Bureau. And he told us straight up, oh, well, when I got to the Detective Bureau in the early to mid 80s, I asked for all of the cold cases so I could brush up. And two were missing. The Manoff murder, another unsolved murder in Springfield that was in, I think, 76 or 77. And the De Palma file. He goes, that file was missing as early as 1984. So, no, Hurricane Floyd did not destroy it. So then we had this kernel of hope. Like, okay, maybe it's misplaced. Or maybe there's a whole other story here that there was some sort of a cover-up. But either way, you know, on the record, you know, anytime we would send a Freedom of Information Act request or an Open Public Records Act request, the bottom line from Springfield was, no, it was destroyed in Floyd, and even if it wasn't, we wouldn't let you see it. It's an open case. The big development that came this past year, you know, 2 years after the book was released, was I subscribe to a lot of newspaper archives online, you know, newspapers.com, newspaperarchive.com, Ancestry, you know, whatever. And I get these email alerts sometimes saying, hey, you know, a whole bunch of articles have been added to the digital database about John List. Come check them out. So I logged in, and sure enough, there were like 50 new John List articles, saved them just for the, you know, the sake of them being interesting. And then I thought, well, hey, when I checked this database a couple years ago, there was virtually nothing on Jeanette. There was a little bit on Joan Kramer, the other girl that was murdered the same week, only a couple towns over, but virtually nothing on Jeanette. So let me search her again. And sure enough, there were a half dozen new articles that were added, and there was stuff about Red, the guy in the woods. We found the correct spelling of his last name. It's Kira, not Kier. So now we have that alley to go down. And it mentioned this this wanted poster for him that was drawn up, and it said something like 7,000 of them were distributed around Union County. And that was a big, big thing because, okay, if 7,000 of these were distributed around Union County, that means it's a public document. It was already released to the public by the police department, which means the prosecutor's office or the Springfield Police Department or any other investigative agency that handled the case could not hide behind, oh, no, we're not releasing it to the public because it's an open case. They had already released it 40-something years ago. So I filed a brand new request, and within 3 weeks, they found the original wanted flyer and mailed me a copy. So it definitively proved that while, yes, maybe the case file that Springfield had was destroyed sometime in the 80s or the 90s, depending on who you want to believe, a copy still exists in the Union County Prosecutor's Office. And we've seen some interesting twists and turns since then. But either way, the bottom line is the files exist somewhere. And now it's just a matter of they won't let the public or journalists or anyone else for that matter see them.
But there's also rumor that the Joan Kramer case files were missing as well.
That was another strange development. I sent the Open Public Records Act request for them probably in 2013. And it's a different county that handled it because she was while she was found in Union, which is Union County jurisdiction, she disappeared from Essex County. So they treated it as a kidnapping first because she was picked up while hitchhiking. So Essex County Prosecutor's Office handles that case. When I sent them the Open Public Records Act request, they kept sending me every 2 weeks these letters saying, hey, hold on, we're still trying to find the file. You got to understand, it's 40-something years ago. We have a lot of different storage facilities. Hang in there, though. We're going to find it for you. And I got three or four of those. And then finally, probably like 5 months after I first, you know, sent the request in, they came back and said, listen, we're so sorry. We checked every storage facility we have diligently. We checked our microfilm archives. We checked everywhere. We don't know where the file is. We're presuming it's lost or destroyed. You know, best of luck to you. So As far as original documentation or paperwork on the Kramer case, there's nothing. All we had to go on while chronicling it for the book was the interviews that we conducted with the people from the prosecutor's office from back then. We interviewed her brother and sister, people that knew the prime suspect in that case, and the newspaper articles. That was it. So even if, say, tomorrow, someone walked into the police station in South Orange and said, "I killed Joan Kramer. Here's why, here's how, and here's something that proves that I did it beyond a reasonable doubt." They would have a hell of a time prosecuting it, if at all, because her files are missing from the prosecutor's office. That's the investigating body that would handle it should a arrest be made. So, I mean, I guess that case is dead in the water over there as far as they're concerned.
And do you have any updates on the Joan Kramer case as far as what you're working on?
Well, the interesting thing about that was, you know, when we first talked to the siblings, they had mentioned, "Oh, well, you know, there was this guy that was arrested for it a few years later. Did you guys know about that?" And we said no, because we were not going digital with this until later. We were old fashioned with getting the information for this case. You know, I spent many hours along with Mark in various public library basements going through microfilm reels. And the Kramer case, much like the De Palma case, just kind of fizzles out at the end of 1972 on these reels. So, you know, we figured, okay, well, I guess they never found anything else. But her family, you know, Joan Kramer's family told us, no, there was a guy arrested for it 3 years later, this guy named Otto Nilsson. He was an accountant living in Maplewood, which is the next town over from South Orange. He used to live in South Orange as well, and they eventually found an eyewitness that put him at the scene when Kramer got into a car hitchhiking, and they tried him for it. And I said, "Well, what came of it?" And they said, "Well, the prosecution didn't do a very good job of presenting the case, and he went free. The jury, you know, acquitted him." And I said, "Well, whatever happened to this guy?" And she said, "Well, a couple years later, he held some doctors hostages at a VA hospital with a rifle, and he was, he was condemned to an asylum, and that's where he died. He died in a mental institution." So, you know, we started looking into this guy, you know, the specter of Otto Nilsson, and, you know, as far as we could find, we could not find anything that put him in Springfield the day that Jeanette De Palma went missing, you know, only a week before Joan Kramer, but we could not find anything that didn't put him there because he worked for himself. You know, he was a certified public accountant. He ran his business out of his apartment. So he could come and go as he pleased. There were no employment records or anything like that to show that he could not have done it. But the interesting thing was, when he went to trial, a lot of his previous hospitalizations for his mental illnesses came out in these articles, like dates, tangible dates, like, you know, he was in this hospital from then till then, and then again from then until then, yada, yada, yada. And when we put them on the timeline, we realized every time this guy was let out of a mental institution, girls would turn up dead in New Jersey, strangled, left face down in the woods. And then the killings would stop as soon as he got committed again. So he was a very, very interesting suspect that we worked with for years, and we considered to be the number one suspect for a time. And then after the book came out, I got a phone call from a prosecutor who used to work in Essex County. And he told me, he goes, "Hey, I just wanted to call you because I was picking up some summer reading for a little trip I was going on. And I'm in Barnes & Noble and I see your book." And I go, "Oh, well, that looks interesting." And I'm flipping through it. I'm like, "Oh, wait, I worked this case, the Kramer case." And he goes, "Yeah, you mentioned Nilsson. Nilsson is a very interesting suspect, but I don't think he killed Kramer." And I'm like, "Okay, so there was another suspect." And he goes, "Oh, yeah, there were a couple other." And so he tells me all about this guy who had been arrested for picking up girls hitchhiking. and, you know, screwing with their cars, kind of like the Zodiac did in the Kathleen Johns case, and picking them up and raping them. One he was acquitted for at trial, another one he was convicted. So we had this other suspect that we were looking at, and then sure enough, when this new newspaper article dump came on newspapers.com, all these articles that were not available to us when we were writing the book, there's the guy. And all of this stuff mentioned about him being a suspect in the Kramer case. So now, in the wake of the book initially being published, Mark and I now have another suspect that we're currently looking into to see if we can account for his whereabouts when Jeanette was killed, and when these other girls, like the ones up in North Bergen, if we can account for his whereabouts to see if he's a viable suspect in those murders as well. So, I mean, this definitely is not a situation where, oh, okay, the book's out, you know, that's our take on it, we're done. The case has never stopped moving, and it's never stopped moving in incredibly interesting directions that can be backed up with the testimony of retired detectives who worked the case, or newspaper archives that we did not have access to, or case files that have suddenly been released to us. It's been incredibly interesting.
So at the end of the day, do you believe Jeanette's murder was satanic in nature or a cult murder?
And you know, I've been wrestling with that question for 5 years now. It just, honestly, it teeter-totters back and forth. When we were, you know, hell-bent on this being Nilsson, when all of the cards seemed to line up that he had not only killed Joan Kramer, but he had also killed Jeanette DePalma, we were like, okay, this is satanic panic. This is the New York Daily News and the Post trying to sell sensational headlines based on some things that her pastor, Jim Tate, had said in interviews. You know, that was kind of it for a little while. We're like, okay, it was an undiscovered serial killer and some, you know, goofy sensational headlines. But then we heard from one of Jeanette's friends, oh no, there was a guy that used to pick her up when she would go hitchhiking, this guy Mike. And I knew him. He was like a year older than me, and we went to the same high school. And there was a little bit of romantic interest there. And I had him over my house one time for a date. And he leaned in to kiss me and saw my crucifix and said, no, sorry, I can't kiss you while you're wearing that. I'm a warlock. And he went on about how he had all of these occult beliefs. And she was like, I know for a fact that Jeanette had gotten into his car a few times while hitchhiking. So I went back to Cindy, Jeanette's sister, and I said, hey, did a guy used to, an older guy in high school, guy with a muscle car, used to pick you and your sister up while you would hitchhike? And she goes, yeah, it's this guy named Mike. So I'm like, oh my God, so this all lined up there, you know, like, okay, well, let me see where this guy lived. And sure enough, he lived only two blocks away from the corner where Jeanette DePalma was last seen alive, the corner of Summit Road and High Point. So I could place him at the last spot she was ever seen alive. You know, she went to the Blattis house, she asked for a ride, Donna's mother said no. And so was it conceivable then that she could have kept walking another two blocks and, you know, either saw Mike or knocked on his door and said, hey, you know, I really need a ride somewhere? And then something happened that resulted in her death? Absolutely. There was that we were going on for a while. And then we got the email about the trapezoid. And then on top of that, another strange thing happened. Right after the book was released, Mark and I, we went on a book tour in New Jersey. And all of these weird New Jersey readers just kept coming to us and going, when are you going to give us some more true crime? I read the book in one sitting. And, you know, there's so many other interesting cases. Have you heard of this case in Franklin? Have you heard of this case in Trenton? All this other stuff. And so I said to Mark, I said, you know, we've got like 40 issues to go through, to peruse through, where we've covered true crime here and there. why don't we put together all of the best cases in one special issue? And he goes, yeah, yeah, do it up. So he gave me all of the issues that I didn't have, some of which were out of print. And for 2 months, I literally read every issue of We're New Jersey cover to cover multiple times, putting this thing together. And in one of the issues, I found a photograph. It sent a chill up my spine because I'm looking at this picture and the caption said, you know, stuff left by devil worshipers in this reservation in North Jersey in the 1990s. And it was a trapezoidal perimeter of broken branches and logs and an arrangement of stones in the middle. And it looked exactly like the newspaper account of what Jeanette was found in. So, you know, yes, Nilsson is still a suspect. And it is always the possibility that this was a serial killer or, you know, perhaps something happened, an accident happened at a party and some kids left her in the woods and never said anything about it. That's a theme that's explored in my second book about the Ricky Casso case that's coming up in the fall. But there is also something now where we cannot disregard the satanic angle of this because we have a suspect that knew her, picked her up when she was hitchhiking, dabbled in the occult, and lived two blocks away from where she was last seen the day she died. We have testimony from people familiar with occultism that the trapezoid is a significant figure in LaVey and Satanism. And now we have photographic evidence from the 1990s, before we ever started looking at the De Palma case, of a similar arrangement that was allegedly found around her body being found in another reservation up in North Jersey. So, I mean, truth is stranger than fiction, right? I mean, you can't discount it.
Jesse, I just wanted to take this time to thank you and your co-author, Mark Moran, for the wonderful book, The Death on the Devil's Teeth. All of your hard work in this investigation. This is certainly very well done, well put together.
Yeah, it's great to shine light on a case.
Well, hey, sure. And, you know, thank you guys, too, because, I mean, this is a little book. It came out on a little indie press, Arcadia/History Press. And, you know, now the word is getting out there to, you know, this great loyal following you have. So hopefully we'll get some more tips coming in and, you know, it will really shine a light on a case that was largely forgotten and some people say intentionally so. So if you want to, if any of you listening want to follow where we're at with the case, where we're going with it, at Weird New Jersey on multiple platforms, Weird New Jersey is on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. And if you want to follow me, I'm at J Pollack Author, J-P-O-L-L-A-C-K Author. And I'm on Twitter and Instagram. And I'm posting updates as they come in. And if you want to pick up a copy of the book, it's on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. It's on the Weird New Jersey website, weirdnewjersey.com. But yeah, wherever books are sold, it's Death on the Devil's Teeth.
Well, thank you again for spending some time with us in the garage.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jesse.
Oh, no, and thank you so much for having me on and picking this case to talk about. It really means a lot.
I want to thank everybody out there, everybody in the True Crime Garage Army for helping spread the word about the show. And more importantly, spreading the word about each of these cases that we cover each week, sharing them on social media. You know, the more eyes and ears that these cases reach, the better chance, the better hope that we have of someday providing a lead or solving one of these cases.
Yeah, and we've been contacted by a lot of law enforcement and people that are working other cases that said, hey, because you covered this and because of your audience and because of your amazing listeners, we've actually got new leads to work on.
Mm-hmm. And you know what's funny, Captain, is one of the things that we covered during this series, the John List case.
Yeah.
It was solved through crowdsourcing.
Yeah.
It was considered one of the worst crimes of that decade and solved after 17 and a half years through crowdsourcing. So it is possible. And we thank everybody for helping out the garage. We thank you for listening, subscribing, and telling a friend.
All right. So it's time for me to tell them the big news.
I don't think we're allowed to talk about that yet.
Okay, well, sorry about that.
Well, thanks a lot, Captain.
All right, well, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Until next week, be good, be kind, and don't litter.